Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and deep devotee of the enchanting androgyny of the moon, Mikala Anne. This week, we welcome interdisciplinary artist, diviner, writer, and educator J.M. Hamadi of Star Night Dwell onto the pod to chat about their forthcoming publication with Reveler Press on the lunar stations. Jay takes us on a journey through the tapestry of night, shining a scholarly light fused with a sense of artistic and praxis embodiment onto a mystical lineage that envelops the imagination and produces the divine speech of birds. How does one envision their own art of cave dwelling, of womb diving, of going into the dark space and emerging with images? What does it mean to view the stars through a lunar aperture, with moon as music, moon as letter, moon as mouth? How does one practice becoming the image by becoming sound, which is a full-bodied experience, when the lunar stations are acknowledged, witnessed, and put into play? All this and more on today's episode of Saturn Vox. This podcast is brought in part by listeners like you. If you want to support the show and its humble host, hop on over to the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox, where you can listen to extended episode content and join in our Discord community server.
Hello. I go by JM, my nom de plume, I guess, which isn't much of one because it's just adding a letter, but people call me Jay. I am an artist, diviner, writer. I teach classes sometimes, and my focus is on the starry layer of the sky, and I guess mostly what I would call an astrological context. But also very much in a magical context as well. I co-authored a publication, the Shams al-Ma'arif, The Sun of Knowledge, a translation of al-Buni's infamous text, really the first, not complete, but mostly complete translation in English with Dr. Mina N. Lowe's, which we talk about the first time I was on your show, perhaps. I don't recall.
I mean, we mentioned it, but I think that there was a push to talk about your work outside of the book. You've been featured on a lot of podcasts talking about that work.
We name dropped it and pretty much left it at that. You're right. We had a great conversation about a lot of other things, which I think were definitely relevant to the book and to my work. So I hope if people haven't heard my first, the first conversation we had on your show, that they should go listen to it, because I was pretty proud of that one. I think you were too.
I was too. That was definitely one of actually my favorite episodes I've done. So I'll definitely link that down in the show notes, but also I'll link the other episodes that you did on the book on other podcasts so that people can have easy access to that as well.
Yeah, in describing my work, I think it's important whether you are interested in Arabic magic, Islamicit magic or not. If you are interested in lunar mansions, the topic that we're going to be talking about today, my travelogue that I do at the beginning of The Sun of Knowledge sort of sets up what I'm going to do in the book that is nearing publication. that I'm not going to talk too much about the details of it in this conversation, but just the referring to the general structure that I've been setting up this soon-to-be book as well as the way that I work with and think about the Lunar Mansions more broadly. So if you're not particularly interested in that kind of magic, the travelogue that I wrote at the beginning is a finely articulated and introductory way to the way that I approach this stuff, as a mixture of art, as a mixture of astrology, as a mixture of magic, as a mixture of light scholarly study around the stars and astronomy, astrology, this sort of thing. So yeah, I'd say that's a pretty good summary of what I do.
Yeah, I would say, like, in terms of the book that is, you know, coming out, that book has been a long time coming. For as long as I've known you, I would say since about 2020, you've always really been one of the only people that I've seen publicly talk a lot about and put a lot of time and study into the Lunar Mansions. And I think this is something that's really been missing from the conversation around astrology in a culture currently.
Yeah, it might be worth it just to talk about my history with the subject briefly, which also oftentimes comes up when talking about the Sun of Knowledge. But I taught a class at the Salem, it used to be called the Salem Summer Symposium. Now I think it's just the Salem Witch Fest, which you have also taught at.
Yep.
But that was in 2020. Yeah. Yeah. That was in, I think, August or September 2020. I taught a class on the Lunar Mansions from Al-Buni, from the Shams al-Ma'arif, in my translation that I was working through at the time from Spanish and Arabic, in my really mixed translational process, and just sharing some of the information that I had translated and a little bit of what I had garnered from other texts, including the Ghayat al-Hakim or the Picatrix, interspersed with it. And I taught that class, and Dr. Enlows, who ended up being the co-author on the book, reached out to me and said that she wanted to do this translation. And that class was really, a game changer, and ended up being the catalyst for the Sun of Knowledge, but also was the first time that I ever did something publicly in regards to Lunar Mansions. So it's been about 3 years since I took that class. And for, I would say, about a year leading up to that class, I had already started doing my research, not only just into the Shams al-Ma'arif and al-Buni, but also into the Lunar Mansions generally. Taking notes on, it was a little later that I came to things like the nakshatras, and the Indian or the Vedic Jyotish approach, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about later. And then the Chinese system, the Shu, even later than that. But yeah, the Arabic material in particular, you know, what is found in the Picatrix, these are some of the first instances that I came across the Lunar Mansions. And this book is, well, if I'm really looking at it now, I mean, honestly, probably closer to 4 years of research. Mm-hmm. And just buildup of information from as many textual sources as possible. Also, so much new media, YouTube videos and podcasts, you know, newer forms of doing research. But yeah, it was really that class that was the catalyst for so much of this. And much of that, as I mentioned, went into the Sun of Knowledge. But the book to come will be all of it.
Okay. Oh man, so exciting. So I have a lot of questions I want to ask, but I think what I'm going to start with is, like, paint a picture for me. Like, what was the original impetus to getting excited about the Lunar Mansions? Like, why that as a focus for you?
I guess I'm feeling a little autobiographical right now, which is actually pretty rare for me. Usually I don't like to talk about my history or my life. I'll do it if I have to, or if someone asks. I won't deny them, but I guess it's just,
I can ask a different question if you want.
No. I'm saying that just as much for myself as I am for the listeners and for you. And I'm like, oh, we're in the Lunar Mansion of the Crow and Raven right now. And also just musing on that. The two separate conversations, one conversation that's happening with you and one that's happening in my own mind at the same time, Gemini placements.
Oh, anyways, yeah, big mood.
I'm going to go back a little further in my own history and say that I really got into astrology through Hermeticism more than a decade ago. My journey with Hermeticism beginning with figures like Crowley and the Golden Dawn, and I mean, where many of us have our start, mm-hmm. With a lot of this stuff. And I'm really, my inroad is more magical, for sure. And it, you don't have to spend a lot of time in Western magic to be brought to astrology, at the very least, to be able to get certain things done with planetary days and hours and whatnot. And sometimes the bug bites you and you go a little bit further into it. Sometimes it doesn't. Some people get a little bitter about it and get snarly towards the astrologers. Some just end up trying to become an astrologer. It tends to be, in my experience, more one or the other, not as much middle ground, at least in the West. But yeah, I really had my beginnings in astrology with Hermeticism. And I guess along that journey, going deeper into traditional astrology in particular, it started at taking me down ancestral pathways. And in studying the, it is not obvious. it might be obvious for people who are studying traditional astrology or have a little bit of that background. But there is a rich history in Islam, in the Middle East, in the Arabic speaking world, but also in the Persianate world, and the Urdu speaking world, as well as other parts of the broader Islamic sphere of things, that there is a rich astrological history, much of it, of course, coming from earlier Greek, and then, which I'm sure I'll talk about later, Indian forms of astrology, as well as a whole mixture of influences. But they also have their own, let's say, for lack of a better term, indigenous forms of astrology, many of which are quite ancient, going deep into Bedouin star lore, for example. The story of Al-Jawza, related to the constellation we know as Orion, is thought to be by some scholars as old as 40,000 years, and could be older. Orion lore and Pleiades lore being quite ancient in many cultures. But so there is a body of star lore and what we would call astrology, or what we could call astrology, what I would call astrology, in that part of the world, which would eventually become the Islamic part of the world. And yeah, with the mixture of astrologies from other parts of the world, you have, especially in medieval times, a very rich body of astrology and magic. I maybe we can talk, I'm sure we will talk a little bit about image magic later, as it's so relevant to the Lunar Mansions. But this form of magic is intimately tied with the astrology, which emerges from this part of the world as well. So this is a rich body of lore, and in my own ancestral explorations around astrology in my ancestry, not talking about Mexican astrology, which is another thing that I'm pretty passionate about, that I'm hoping to do more work on in the near future, but on the Arabic speaking, the Arab side, on the Muslim side of my family, going into my astrological ancestry there, brought me to the lunar mansions, or what I'm more often than not calling the lunar stations nowadays. The terms are interchangeable. You can use both. I think it largely falls along lines of preference. But this makes up a huge, huge part, as you can see in texts like the Shams al-Ma'arif, of this same rich body of astrological lore. And so it is this exploration of astrology, but also astrology in an ancestral context for me, that really brought me to the lunar mansions and the Arabic lunar mansions or lunar stations in particular. And I think many of us have been doing a lot more of that ancestral exploration thing. I think when Saturn went into Capricorn, you saw a lot more of that. And Pluto's also movement through Capricorn brought on a lot more of that. Just a light astrological observation on my end. But yeah, it was very much through ancestry that brought me to the lunar stations.
Oh, that's beautiful. So it was an acknowledgement of the passion and dedication and love of the stars of your ancestors that brought you into closeness with this tradition of star lore and the way that the moon passes through each station. But also you brought up this, the image magic. So there's also a pull not only from your ancestry, but also from what drives your inner passion as an artist. So it seems like it touched two different aspects of, like, speaking of Gemini, the multiplicated self, like the self that's woven within the ancestors and the self that's independently woven.
Exactly. And the lunar stations in particular have such a strong imagistic quality about them. Not that other aspects of astrology don't. When we think of a solar zodiacal sign, for example, Taurus, we think of the bull. And in the northern hemisphere especially, we think of spring. We maybe think of the color green. There are, of course, imagistic associations with other aspects of astrology. But the lunar stations have, as is typical for the moon, a plurality of images around each station, as the moon is a gatherer or a collector of sorts. And as the moon makes her, his, their journey through the night sky, there is an imagistic or imaginative process at work, which I feel like I've gone on at length about in almost all of my work, that there is a collection. If we think of the moon as a body of water, there is a collection of starlight in that body of water, and a process of translation at work there as well. And also a process of containment, the moon holding and embodying these various lights. And I mean, this is what an image is. An image is a contrast between light and dark. At a fundamental level, when we think of an image, it is something as opposed to nothing. And the most fundamental something, maybe as opposed to is the wrong way of putting it, is it is a something in contrast to a nothing, a light in contrast to dark. This is the most fundamental manifestation of that, right? So yeah, the starlight that the moon gathers along their journey, these are the plurality of images that I'm talking about with the lunar stations, that because the sun radiates its own light, there's a different process at work, right? Rather than gathering the light of so many others, so many other suns in the cosmos. And so once again, though there are images in other parts of, at least in Western astrology, where most people are learning astrology of the sun, the astrology of the moon is very imagistic. And this is why I believe it is so imagistic. I think it's worth mentioning that the lunar stations, as we are referring to them in this show, are the various houses, domiciles, places that the moon moves through. In the Vedic system, it is 27, although 28 if you include the star Vega, which is Abhijit, but 28 in the other systems, the Arabic and the Chinese being the two other most prominent ones. And just as we have 12 zodiacal houses of the sun, there are mostly 28 houses of the moon in her, their, his monthly journey across the sky. And though the solar zodiac that we're talking about has been largely disassociated, although it is a little bit more so related, but still not entirely in Jyotish, in the Vedic or Indian system. In the West, it's been almost completely detached from the constellations that the zodiacal images have come from. Once again, as I said, Taurus, Aries, etc., etc. This is not the case with the lunar stations. We're talking about a zodiac of the night, as the moon is observable at night, of course. It's interesting because the Arabic iteration of the lunar stations waffles in between the two. The early Arabic astrologers were actually still using sidereal coordinates for the lunar zodiac, and it wasn't until later on that they ended up making the switch to a tropical coordinate system for it. Tropical being that it is not taking the precession of the equinoxes into account in the same way, and it is not locked to the physically observable, let's say, star in the night sky and what is rising on the eastern horizon in particular at spring. This is the primary distinction, although even in sidereal astrology, that it isn't that cut and dry either, that it's still just attached to the stars itself. But I don't want to go too much into all these technicalities around it. There's other great material people can look into that's readily available on the differences between sidereal and tropical astrology, let's say. But it's just worth mentioning that the Arabic system is somewhere in between, whereas the Chinese system and the Indian system tends to, for the most part, remain wholly sidereal or of the stars. And I have, in my own idiosyncratic process, sort of come up with my own system for what works for me. And I think it honestly works best, especially in speaking about the magical applications of these things, that one comes to their own system and what works best for them. But the magic that I've found around the lunar stations, in the same way that you're talking about them, as being imagistic, as being aligned with an art practice in this way, and as you said, being so much an impetus for furthering that study on my end, is like, oh well, I'm also an artist, and this is one more reason to go deeper into this thing. Mm-hmm. because it is so aligned with image magic. And I have found that whether it is establishing the coordinates to do this form of magic or any other aspect of it, that in its imagistic quality, it tends to work best when it becomes wholly idiosyncratic, when it becomes an art practice all its own. And I think that was part of that initial attraction for me, beyond the ancestral component, seeing how there is a magic of images so deeply entrenched in the lunar stations. Although, you know, I will say that it finds its apex in the Arabic or Islamicate manifestation of it, where it is these images which are very much still based in the constellations or in the stars themselves. And what I mean by that is the derivation of these images, meaning what one would draw on a talisman, for example. Mm-hmm. It is still very much based in the images of the stars. Some people have, I think, forgotten that, but it sees its apex in the Arabic magical systems that take these starry images and then apply them to talismans in particular, more often than not drawing these images in various kinds of metal, but it could also be done on paper, it could be done on a variety of substance. And I think there is quite a bit of room for creativity around these things. But of course, in my exploration of the Arabic system, it would lead me to this form of magic, which is so inextricably linked to the lunar stations.
Okay. So what you're saying is that the way that the moon traces their progression across the sky and how it interacts literally in the sky with the stars it's moving over creates, because she or they are like of a watery substance, then reflect, such as a mirror, that image out, or like there becomes like a connection between her and the image, or them and the image of the stars, sort of like the way the a photograph develops. And you can.
Yeah. And I'm just glad you said that, because I briefly want to say that I do see it as a two-way street or a many-way street, and that it isn't just the moon, let's say, absorbing light from the stars and then transmitting it to us on Earth. I think that process also goes the other way, that as we are. And every time I say this, I'm like, damn you, Crowley, like, you know, everyone's a star. Like, it's not exactly how I mean it, but in some sense, I do also mean it that way. But that the moon is also transmitting our unique lights. But not just, I don't mean that in an anthropocentric way. I mean the light of what we would think of as terrestrial beings, including the lights of animals and plants and all those other beings, and non-human and non-animal and non-botanical beings that dwell in this earthly plane with us, back, that the moon is also translating our light and transmitting it back to the stars as well. Yeah. So that they tell stories about us as well.
Beautiful. Yeah, they are reflecting the creative light of all beings in all the many directions that, I mean, they're a sphere, so they're catching it from any direction that it is sent, right?
Yeah, it is spherical. Yeah, it isn't even just a two-way street, it's a many-way street.
Love that for them. Quite a powerful luminary.
Yeah, I see the moon as a locus of imagination. That hasn't changed in the way that I approach the moon.
The way that I like saw it in my head when you were describing this process was like, of course it. They also catch our light, because what else is image magic but not us catching the moon at a specific time and flashing an image at them that we want to be permeated across the subconscious imagination, right?
Exactly. It's a reflection of a reflection of a reflection, which is sort of how lunar magic tends to operate. It's very reflecty, right? Which, I mean, you could call the moon watery, and many cultures do, and water is reflective in that way. And it's also life-giving. Oftentimes, I think in the more, for lack of a better term, patriarchal iterations of this stuff, the moon and its reflective quality is thought to be illusionistic and deceptive, as well as not in that way, not nourishing or life-giving, but there's a deep nourishing quality to the moon. And just because something is reflective wouldn't invalidate that, although that oftentimes still seems like a bias for many. But aside from that, I think that is, yes, largely how lunar magic functions, where its efficacy comes from, in a reflective quality of an image on an image on top of an image. You have starlight, of course, moving through moonlight, moving through the light of the substance that one is using, as well as the mutual reflection of whatever the image may be, the head of a lion, someone holding a pail of water, being reflected back between the image that is crafted and the image of the moon and the image of the star itself, as well as, of course, incantation and incense and substance something like stone and material, which, you know, these things are associated, especially stones, gemstones, with stars themselves, right? We see this in the Bahinian lists, as well as all kinds of astrological magic. And so it is this, it goes beyond correspondence tables. It can go far beyond correspondence tables once you become immersed in it, where the spirits of these things begin to, you know, have their own idiosyncratic correspondences unto themselves. But yeah, it's image reflecting image on top of image, and also light and breath and things we would think of as very hard substances, these things having their own form of image unto themselves, and their own way of speaking. And this all coming together in the act, which is more than just this act, but in the culmination of the drawing of an image at a particular time, which is the hallmark of what is called image magic, or astrological image magic, or sometimes Arabic image magic, which is honestly not so Arabic at the end, and not even so astrological, except for the determining of particular times, which I think that this kind of magic can be done outside of the very specific astrological timing that is done more often than not, but that it doesn't lose efficacy being done outside of that, which is maybe more of a marginal opinion.
Interesting. So you're saying you don't have to just use electional astrology to make a image magic talisman?
I don't think that it's necessary for what I would call a broader image magic.
Okay.
I think that the images, just like our language, just like our prayer, has a life unto itself.
Yeah.
If you are working within that paradigm, I think that absolutely it is optimal for that efficacy to do as many things as you can to make something functional. And by this I mean coming to an auspicious time for your working, this is something that adds to that efficacy. But I don't think that it is a complete necessity, especially for those who work more along the, let's say, imaginative lines of things, or work more closely with the spirits that reside in these different places, the spirits of the stars, the spirits of the lunar stations, for example, as has now become, I don't want to say a cliche, but seemingly, you know, everyone talks about it now, a more quote unquote animist or relational approach to these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It has become almost a norm to hear people say, well, it's you want to have a relationship beforehand before going deeper into these things. And I largely agree. Though the part of me that wants to keep things super esoteric and occulted or whatever is like, no, like, you cannot know the secrets. Like, I mean, that's basically how it goes. It's going to look a little different for everyone, but the relationship forming part, I think, is the most fundamental thing. And once those relationships are coherent enough, I think a lot of the particulars of astrological timing and whatnot can frankly be bypassed. But this is something you hear in all forms of magic, right? Like you leave the book paradigm behind, you leave the paradigm of following directions behind once you actually are more fully immersed in a thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. At first I was like drawn to thinking, well, what we're talking about is a more sorceress practice in general, because we're dealing with the moon, and you'd already like mentioned the counter between lunar and solar astrology, and there is, you know, this like identity based aspect to that solar quality versus this like imagistic reflection between self and other that we get with the moon. But of course, the sun has like its own spirits you can develop a relationship with as well. So it's not quite cut and dry, but there is this like more darker sorceress, like relational quality already to approaching something through a lunar perspective over a solar one.
Yeah, I think a lot of that can be chalked up to just looking up and being able to see the moon and then the stars that are near to the moon when it is in, you know, whatever domicile or place that it is in, which I'm gonna there's no point in doing a podcast if you can't have a little rant on it. why bother going on someone's show if you can't rant or complain about something. I've been, especially since the publication of The Sun of Knowledge, been on my little tirades trying to deconstruct the Western paradigm of the Picatrix, which is actually the Ghayat al-Hakim and an Arabic text, which hopefully Liana Saif's translation of the Arabic comes out in the near future, so people can begin to see that text is actually has roots in the, you know, what is at least trendy to call now the Islamicate tradition, but at least in more academically inclined circles. So I'll play along with that. But that text in its Latin and then into English translation has a lot of people in the Western world, and in particular the English-speaking world, thinking that Muslim people do that kind of magic. And by that kind of magic, I mean super advanced calculations in this, you know, what we think of as astrological magic paradigm. Or even that is beyond, like, English-speaking people and their ideas around Muslim people or Arabic-speaking, Persian-speaking people, what have you, even beyond their perception of people from that other browner side of the world, that even that this is the only way to do what we call astrological magic, period. That magic and astrology coming together, that the paradigm of the Picatrix is the only way to do that. And my little tirades, as I'm referring to them, have been about deconstructing that paradigm as much as I can, beginning with the Sun of Knowledge to show that, for one, if Muslim people are doing magic at all, which is, I mean, that's a provocative thing to say in itself, frankly, or just even that assumption, which is an Orientalist assumption, I think, in itself, if we're going to refer to that as magic the same way that we would refer to magic in the West. I don't think those are even necessarily the same things. But that's its own thing, that it looks something like the magic of the Picatrix. This is, for the most part, not the case, as well as astrological magic outside of the Western paradigm, that it looks something like the Picatrix. That is also not necessarily and most likely not the case. So I think deconstructing that paradigm is important, especially for quote-unquote Western magicians. And to limit it to try to bring it back to the lunar mansions, it is this observational process of just looking up at the moon and the stars or around it that this form of magic is born from, as well as an astrological magic which is accessible to the people. And if, let's say, once again, Muslim, the Islamic people of the Islamic world, people, if they are doing this kind of magic, would be doing it because of this level of accessibility around it. And of course, it's going to get mixed with Quranic verses. It's going to get mixed with things that are of the culture. Mm-hmm. Very rarely complex astrological calculations that, frankly, people of the time, but also of this time, it is mostly elites who are doing this or even transmitting the information, not necessarily even doing that magic themselves. But it is this accessibility of the moon and looking at the moon, which lends itself to both the astrology, not just the magic, but the astrology and the magic around this stuff. And that, because it is so many stars, with the moon in the foreground, this is by its very nature more imagistic than just looking up at the sun, the big bright spotlight in the sky, right? Of course, there's other weather phenomena, which is its own form of image magic, especially in other cultures. Like, what are the clouds doing? Is there a rainbow? Other daytime phenomena, which in many other cultures is related to things that are also happening in the sky at night and during the day. We make this distinction. We often don't include things like weather phenomena, but it is our whole system of Western astrology is in many respects still based on it. Once again, people forget it. The Arabic lore around the stars is based in something that's called the Anwa literature, which is all this kind of weather phenomena mixed with star lore and lunar mansions. The house system in Western astrology comes from the same divisions of the sky, but also what's happening on the ground and the weather phenomena that's happening around us. Of everyday life, the sun is rising in the east. We see the 10th house is the sun directly above us. We see the 12th house is the sun just having risen from the east, as well as the weather phenomena that's happening right at our level, including things like mosquitoes, including things like wind, things that deteriorate or cause illness. The 12th and the 6th, which are directly above and directly below us. So, you know, we've become so utterly detached from all of this, but our Western systems are also based upon it. People just forget it. Many other cultures have not forgotten this and still utilize this stuff. But yeah, it is that everyday accessibility that I think makes for not only the more imagistic moon as opposed to the sun, but also, you know, so many forms of magic and the plurality that can come from it, as opposed to something which is based on, you know, intense calculation, for example, right? This is a limiting factor on imagination at some level, I think, unless you're a mathematician, then that is where your imagination goes.
Okay, I love this. I'm really glad you went on this rant. What you're saying is that there's like a reductionism on etymagic from the Western perspective when we reduce it to just what we saw in the Picatrix, because that was already in and of itself something that was written by people of one class type and one group. And there was a larger practice of like, and maybe folk traditions and like storytelling and mythology weaving that was just as large a part of the culture that the West doesn't take into account. And this is more what distinguishes that relational aspect between approaching astrology from a solar perspective versus from a lunar perspective.
Yeah, exactly. That I think the solar lunar distinction, there's obviously a lot there. Some people could also chalk that up to a similar discussion around sidereal and tropical distinction as well. But things having to do with the sun and the calculations around solar astrology, I think, begin to lend themselves more and more to exactly that calculation, as opposed to the more what I'm calling imagistic qualities of looking up the moon or stars, or really just nighttime phenomena in general. It is the darkness of night that, like a blank canvas, we begin to, in this same process of reflection and projection, all this, project so much of our own consciousness and unconsciousness onto the night sky and the our surroundings in this same way. I think more than anything, even beyond the moon and the sun, it is a quality of day and night, where in the daytime things just feel more clearly established as what they are, and in the night there seems to be there is an ambiguity around things. There's a kind of unpredictability. There's a pregnant potential, if you will, that just exists in the night that you don't get with the day.
Yeah, and then you're bringing it back into this like imaginational image creating. Everything is kind of shape shifting. Maybe there, and there's that like sorceress quality of like, I can snapshot my own light at the gathering waters of the moon and have that permeate into the imaginal reality.
Yeah, I this is something I think about endlessly. And I taught a class about almost a year ago now, I'd say, called Moon Draws Upon Earth. Is very much exploring much of what we're talking about. There is a Patreon for the show. My podcast, which I didn't bring up, called A Star Night Dwell, where Mikala has been on the show as well. We did a swap cast, which is the first time that I went on their show. But on the Patreon, this class is available for anyone who is interested. But it is an exploration of it's an imaginative exploration, which is speculative history, as I refer to it. Not quite conspiratorial history per se, although I guess I could see how it like leans into that genre. And it's weird because that's so much my background with a lot of this stuff as well. But I am exploring the roots of much of what we're talking about in the way that sky observation ends up becoming something like how we would use the lunar mansions in a contemporary sense, or something like image magic. And I began with these dot images found in caves all over the world, these little dot diagrams. The one in Lascaux in particular being much speculated on being connected to Taurus and the Pleiades, of course, as I mentioned, so much Pleiades and Orion lore going back, and Orion as well being part of these dot images, as well as being intermixed with these pictures of animals, oftentimes herd animals, but also predatory animals in these different caves. And seeing how this, we don't know in the scientific sense, and maybe never will, whether this is exactly what they were attempting to depict, the sky, the night sky, I mean. But I think it works imagistically. I think that's probably what it is. And I think people's hunches are correct on that. But what is this, and this is what I'm attempting to explore, what is this process of translation in the way that the moon does it, this process of translation from actually looking up and seeing these stars and the way that they look, their images, right? In the light hitting our eyeballs, and our eyeballs are like little spherical white moons, like that too, right? And they go through this weird dark side, like Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, refracting rainbow process inside of the gelatin that makes up our eyeballs and ends up in our brain in that very physicalist way of looking at it. But what is the mental or the psychical transfer of this information or process of translation that ends up having someone 20,000 years ago looking up at the stars and then going into a cave, lighting a fire and drawing these same dots, these starry dots into the cave. This is what I'm interested in. And also how this ends up leading to things like alphabets. This is actually the main part of the class is how this leads to alphabets, because there are so many letter correspondences that are found between the lunar stations. Once again, being very imagistic, and alphabets. So how does one thing lead to the next? For example, in the Arabic tradition, how do we get Arabic letter correspondences with the lunar stations? There is an entire history. There's an entire history of imagination of sky observation going far beyond, you know, Islam and the Arabs in particular, that leads people to come to this kind of thing, or to embody or to create this kind of thing, and then to put it in a book. And so this is the process that I'm interested in, how this happens. And of course, once again, speculative history, history of the imagination stuff. It's not like this is the definitive way that it happened. It's an exploration as such. I think everything we're talking about falls into this at some level, because as you know, and as we talked about the first time I came on your show, art and magic are not all that different in that respect. They're not exactly the same thing, I would say, but they're fairly close. And I think this is one of the places, or one of the ways of talking about how they are close to one another, and also seeing their similar origins and roots in something like this, which is a way that people have described the origins of art, going back to the caves, right? And seeing how the first things we would call paintings were in this kind of environment. And I, once again, I don't think it's by accident that the inklings of the alphabet, the inklings of language, the inklings of astrology, and the inklings of art, and the inklings of magic, to add another inkling in there, all have their roots in the same place. We can go back to, like, what is it, this thing about going into the dark place, whether it's being out at night or going into the even darker place of a cave, right? That pregnant potential. Mm-hmm. What is it about going into that dark womb-like space and emerging with all of these images, emerging with all the things that we associate with imagination, art, magic?
Jesus, this is fascinating. Right? No, yeah, I love this. It did make me think about our last conversation, because a lot of this lines up with, like, my ontological view of the way that language and mythology and metaphor shapes the way that we experience the phenomenological reality. So this idea that the moon, which in a lot of different cultures, but from my perspective, very specifically Kabbalah, like the practice of my ancestors, the moon shapes what occurs on the physical reality, not the other way around. And this, like, thing that you're picking up on, that, like, language is tied to humans looking up at the moon, art and metaphor are tied to that by people using this illuminating orb in the darkness to look at all the other pregnant potentialities in the sky. That's insanely cool. And how did people, like, start to develop stories from that? Like, I know you were talking about weather patterns and, like, the way that the seasons change and the way that the ground changes, you know, how animals migrate, plants grow and die. That probably had something to do with it. But, like, I'm also very interested in how the stories were woven, because a culture's story, their imaginative quality is going to shape their epistemological values. So it really is always starts with the moon and then kind of feeds down to how we interact with the world around us.
Completely. And I'm glad you brought up story, which I think I would take story and go, I guess, ontologically prior to that, or at least to the speaking of story, oral traditions, what have you, to just sound in general. Mm-hmm. And I would even go from there to say music. Talking about images, the image that I use to essentially lead the way with the class, but also leads the way for me in my practice, and is related to the travelogue and all the stuff that I've been talking about, is actually the various shapes that the moon makes in its different phases, being a language, as I referred to it in the Sun of Knowledge, the archaic language of the moon, which is maybe not a language in the way that we think of it, and is closer to a set of sounds. And so in this same class, Moon Draws Upon Earth, that I was referring to, I go through these different lunar phases and show how they relate to these archaic or primeval images that we're talking about, that might be depicted in cave art, let's say, or that something closer to the root of where a letter in an alphabet might come from. Mm-hmm. But the lunar phases are really the leading image or images for me in this instance. And let me give an example. I talked about it a little bit on other podcasts, but it's the difference between the full moon, let's say, which is in the Arabic system is often related to the letter mim, which has a mm sound, the letter M, mm-hmm. which is a humming that involves the mouth being closed to actually make the sound. Right. And then contrast that with the new moon, which is like an ah sound, which the moon is open, which you need to open your mouth to be able to make that sound. Whether you look at the new moon or it's opposite the full moon as opened or closed, I think is, I think it depends on the way you look at it. And I think it's one of those instances that's both and. You could see both as being open and you can see both as being closed. And in that way, they are opposite one another or in contrast to one another. But it is this movement of the mouth, right? And I know you have a lot of this in the, I believe it's the Sefer Yetzirah. You have a lot of this in Kabbalah,
yeah,
Kabbalistic
absolutely.
Lore, referring to the letters and the opening of the mouth, the closing of the mouth.
Well, the Hebrew calendar is lunar as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Even the letters being, you know, like tongues in certain instances. And you see this emphasis on the movement of the mouth. But I, in this leading image sense, I see the moon as a kind of mouth. Or I've also referred to it as an aperture for light, mm-hmm. Like a camera being, and you referred to, you know, the photographic image earlier, and I think that's on point. The moon is like a camera opening and closing for letting certain amounts of light in or not. But I prefer the mouth metaphor as, especially when we're talking about letters and correspondence between letters and the alphabet, right? Because the ah is like the letter aleph. It's open, and you could give that to the new moon, or you could give that to the closed moon. And oftentimes, it is given to the new moon or the beginning of the lunar cycle, beginning with the new moon. And the letter mim, the closed mouth, is given to the full moon. The mouth is closed because the moon is saturated with light. It's full, just like if you had a bunch of food in your mouth, your mouth would be closed and that's the kind of sound that you would be making. Or even if you had a bunch of water, right? And it's and meme is a watery letter in that way, and that and noon is the following letter in the Arabic alphabet as well, is also considered to be very watery, as well as being a reference to water in some respects. So this is the way that these things become embodied. This is also the way that we see a kind of mystical lineage through embodiment, the way that these things are not just, you know, passed down necessarily from one book to another, although that is how they're passed down, but the way these things actually manifest from the people who see it in this way. And in this way, you see the embodiment of these things, how magic becomes embodied, how something like incantation, something like prayer, something that involves the recitation of language, that involves recitation of any sort, factors into something like this. You can see the metaphysical efficacy behind these things. And also how these systems from a mystical sense relate to Kabbalah, relate to Sufism, relate to various forms of mysticism. This isn't something that is abstract. This is something that's completely embodied. So I take this form of the moon as the mouth, very near and dear to my heart. And this is sort of my guiding image, alongside the moon being as a kind of aperture between light and dark. And this is this mouth that is the moon could be thought of as the speech of deity, the speech of the divine. I'm not going to sound heretical and say the speech of God and act like I know what that is. I understand the language of Allah. I'm not going to do that or say that, but the divine speech of a kind, at the very least, the mantiq al-tayr, the speech of the birds, this kind of mystical language, right, can be seen as in the moon. And the phases of the moon look like a mouth opening and closing, could look like a mouth opening, closing, as well as a letter, like a crescent moon kind of looks like the letter C, or looks like the letter Dalet, the D in the Semitic alphabet, or the full moon looking like an O, or the new moon looking like an O, etc., etc., on and on. The sliver that is Aleph being the sliver of the new moon, right? So yeah, I mean, this is how I think all of these things connect. And of course, this is not a linear connection by any means. But this is how the magic connects to the astrology, connects to the mystical literature, connects to the way that these things become embodied, connects to the efficacy behind these different things. Yeah, that was a big, long thing.
No, I mean, that was fascinating. This like concept of sound and the moon and the mouth is like a very palatable image, especially like when my like point of reference here really being the invocation to Mene, which actually you you mentioned in the last podcast we did. And then of course, like I went out and did it afterwards, but I enjoyed that. And what I like so much about that invocation and the PGM is the fact that it does kind of follow the lunar mansions, or it seems to follow some sort of lunar pattern that has an image as well as a sound. Exactly. So it has both. And you have to actually say these sounds, which becomes very theatrical and very like you are kind of becoming that image by reflecting the sound, which is a full-bodied experience.
Exactly. Yeah, I forgot you had asked about story, and just to connect it back, the roots of story being sound, right? And so leading with the moon and the mouth that is the moon making these different sounds, you can then go to something like the prayer to Mene and see how these different sounds become associated with not only the lunar phases, but the lunar mansions. And of course, the lunar phases can tie in directly with the stations. I mean, I say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim in the name of God, it's like that is still, that could be the beginning of a story, that could be the beginning of a verse in the Quran, but that is still connected to a sound and a letter, right? Consequently, so every story begins with a sound. Whether it be Om, whether it be the letter B, Ba, you know, in the Bismillah Rahman Rahim, whatever it may be, the religious text, the story begins with a sound, and in this way, I'm connecting it to your question around story, seeing the sound as the root of it. But yeah, the prayer to Mene is just another great example of exactly that. And the PGM is a good example because it comes from this very eclectic milieu that is Alexandria, or Egypt at the time, right? That is taking from all of these different traditions that do emphasize sound as the primary means of creation. You can go into the all the Abrahamic influences in the PGM, the Judaic influences that you speak of God creating through speech in this way, and every recitation of the holy work in all of the Abrahamic traditions is a revivification of this same initial act of God's creation. I think we even talked about that a little bit the first time we spoke on our respective podcasts. But so you have this influence, and then you have the Egyptian influence in the PGM, which emphasizes this as well, the heka of all of it, wherein speech is magical itself, right? And is the primary mode of magic, as well as the way this all connects to image. But the primary influences in the PGM all come from cultures that emphasize this. And of course, the connection with the moon speaks to exactly that. So it's no wonder that something like the Prayer to Mene or the Arabic letters in the Lunar Mansions or any of this stuff ends up being what it is. In this way, something like image magic, another part of my ongoing rant is that I see image magic, or everything we've been talking about that is loosely lumped into image magic, as being a natural extension of the magic in this part of the world, not just for Islam, but for the broader Mediterranean, for the Middle East, for North Africa, even. I just see it as this natural progression all the way from the caves into what people were already doing and into what these traditions going all the way back to ancient Egypt have been emphasizing.
No, yeah, I love that. I love that you mentioned that, because it brings to attention the West's like overemphasis on high logic and this like cleanliness, whereas the moon, and like, this is what I was going to say actually, is like, what you're talking about actually sends shivers down my spine. I mean, we're like, speaking of the moon, we're like bridging on like high priestess territory, this like peeking beyond the veil or like playing with the intangible, because I can in some ways rationalize, okay, the metaphors that I use to talk about something. So we're talking about story, we're talking about folklore, the way that the metaphors shape the way that I experience my phenomenological reality. Like, I can make logic sense of that. But when you bring up the way that this all comes from sound, and that is like the language of the divine is like this sound, that's more intangible. That's like something I feel in the body, which I think you were the first astrologer who mentioned to me that there's something embodied about the moon as well. So this is like all very much, as opposed to being high logic, like we have to rationalize everything, everything has to have an empirical value. We're talking about a felt sense, which is more mythological.
Exactly. I mean, you are, every time you open your mouth and make an ah sound or pronounce the letter A or any of that, you are doing Aleph. And in that way, you are doing Al-Sharatayn, you're doing the first Arabic lunar mansion. If you do that correspondence, let's say, you are reenacting that same original creation just every time you speak. And in that way, language is sacred, which reminds us, you know, we have to be careful about what we say. And also that what we mm-hmm. say matters too. Everything mm-hmm. we say, even if we think that it doesn't, or even if we forget that it doesn't. This is the kind of embodiment that I speak of. Like, it's happening whether you believe it is or not, whether you want it to or not. And in that way, yeah, mysticism, the lunar mansions, magic in general, it's not an abstract thing. And even in astrology, which, you know, as we've been talking about throughout this conversation, has become very skewed towards the rationalistic tendencies in the West, the moon is still, even in Western astrology, very much thought to be the planet of embodiment, or having to do with the body. And that isn't entirely different in, let's say, Vedic astrology, for example, but they do have this notion of moon as mind as well, whereas we tend to, in the Western astrology, keep it just to things like the emotions, which that's also sort of vague too, like, oh, the moon is about emotions. Well, what are emotions? Right? That's mm-hmm. that's not just an easy answer. But I like that the moon is the mind in Vedic astrology. because the mind is something that, at least if you can get past that, which if you're doing this kind of thing, like practicing astrology, for example, I would hope you would not be mired in these kinds of binaries. But the mind is something that permeates both body and, you know, what we see around us, subject and object, however you want to refer to it. Mind permeates both. And so the moon isn't just body, although it is, but it's also the way that body interacts with environment and is environment in some sense as well. Mm-hmm. And the moon also describing mother being the womb, right? Which is the environment that you existed in before you came into this world, but also in some sense, the environment that you, that we spend most of our time with in the other world before we are born into material reality in that same way. Hence the moon is imaginatrix too.
Yeah, there's that like pregnant with possibility. Exactly. Again, with that cave imagery and what we can create in the night.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which, I mean, oh, you want to give that to a lunar mansion? Al-Butain in the Arabic, or as it's sometimes referred to, Al-Batin, the interior, which is also the Arabic word for the esoteric, which is also has been historically used as kind of a slur towards people who end up, such as ourselves, who end up getting so wrapped up in this stuff, the botanist, the botany.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's in the nakshatra. So I realized I said at the beginning of the show that I would speak a little bit more about it, but the nakshatra, or the Indian or Vedic manifestation of the lunar mansions, they are exactly that, which they have their own history, which goes back into the Vedas, into the actual Vedic literature, where they're very much tied into ritual cycles more than anything else, and auspicious timing around ritual cycles. So propitiating certain deities, for example, offering sacrifice to particular deities, each nakshatra being related to a particular deity or to a set of particular deities, as well as all of the things that come with that. And this pregnant with possibility lunar station being Bharani, which in every system, in the Arabic, in the Chinese, in the Indian, is the womb, is the dark womb. That symbolism pervades it, which once again, it's in a part of the sky that doesn't have that many stars. It's around the faint mm-hmm. stars of Aries, which there really aren't that many stars in that part of the sky. Coming from the around the part of the sky that has Pisces in it, which also the stars are very faint. These things cross cultures in this way, including the different imagery. I'm going to refrain from trying to even give a brief history on the Chinese system of lunar mansions, as it's the newest for me, and in that way, and also in its complexity and beauty. I guess the most opaque for me. And so I don't want to say too much on it out of respect for that, but also having not given it the time that I feel it really deserves. But the name is the Shu. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's oftentimes put in English as XIU. And it very much mirrors the other systems in the stars that are used, as well as much of the imagery. But yeah, there's even a lunar station in my mind for that same pregnant possibility. The deity who rules the nakshatra mm-hmm. is Yama, the god of the dead. And this lunar station is the land of the dead. And in that way, it represents the other world wherein all of those possibilities, including souls waiting to reincarnate and everything else, including ideas and concepts waiting to reincarnate back into the world, in the place where there is no time, wait, or perhaps never will be manifested back again. and it is related to the deity who oversees that vast bureaucracy, that Kafka-esque bureaucracy that is the other world. like so many animes, like so many great animes have showed us.
Beautiful. So what you're saying is, like, at their core, every lunar station, whether it is from the Arabic, the Jyotish, or the Chinese perspective, we are, like, looking at a story, a sound, and a picture. And so it's not so much like these categories of delineation. It is how do the combination of these stories, sounds, and pictures make you feel? What does, like, it evoke in your memory? What does it make you sense in your body? And through gaining a deeper understanding of those energies, you can start to, I guess there are two different ways you can develop relationship with the different spirits of these stations, or you can kind of capture a moment in a talisman and carry that energetic imprint with you to help create that story in your own life, or create those feelings or those images within the narrative of whatever you're trying to weave, good or bad, within yourself or the lives of others, I guess, in a very sorcerous way, as one does.
Exactly. And I mean, in that way, it's really I think you could lump it in with pretty much, I don't want to say every, because someone will chime in with the exception, of course, but with most forms of what we would call divination. And then the way that those most forms of divination relate to magic, take for example, Ramal or geomancy, specifically in its Arabic form, but you know, there's many people like Sam Block and Dr. Al Cummins who have also shown that it can and does exist in the English forms of geomancy as well. But the Ifa corpus, for example, right, and Ifa, mm-hmm, being related to these same or similar figures, so the geomantic figures, bring it to playing cards, bring it to tarot cards. All of these systems have in common the same thing that you're describing, that involves image, right? Whether it be the image of the figure, the image of the Ifa figure, the tarot card, the playing card, mm-hmm, et cetera, the image in the I Ching, or the star image, the actual, like, dot constellation itself, or even the image associated with the star. And then in all of those systems, you have a story of some sort, or an aphorism, or a sound, or a musical thing. I mean, the correspondences go on and on, you know. In Ramal, they oftentimes have the planets. But in the original Arabic geomancy, they're also associated with certain Arabic verses from the Quran. In Ifa, there's a massive corpus of prayer, of ebo, or sacrifice, and, mm-hmm, remediation, as well as, you know, prayer and cultural lore that comes with every Ifa figure and every combination as such. Tarot cards, it's the same thing. And you know, there's stories that come with the cards. There's all kinds of correspondences, as well as, just like in Ramal, just like in cartomancy, people use the images, they use the figures, and they use the cards for various forms of magic. The divination and the lunar mansions are no different in this way, right? It's essentially the same. I prefer to approach this stuff on the unity of all these different forms of divination, which, I mean, pretty much have the same roots and function in a similar manner, honestly. Not to mm-hmm, not to glaze over the differences and the beauty of the differences, the cultural differences, of course. I revel in that, but
but in true Gemini fashion, two things can be true at once.
Yeah, or you know, a thousand things can be true at once, which is sort of how I see this.
You know, what's so cool about all of this to me is how it does tie in to the arts and being an artist, because it opens up this like immense multiplicity of creative expressions that one can make to harness and move through and get to know these energies, like whether you want to make music or you want to draw a picture or, you know, some sort of weird combination of the two, or write a poem or create an outfit, you know, inspired by the way that the season of that, you know, station feels. All of these things kind of open up to you as like a ritual performance, which is like interestingly Moon qualities too.
And that is that is how the book, without saying too much about it, that is how the book is structured in many ways. And that is, as I talked about, the guiding light for the lunar mentions being the moon as a mouth speaking, for so much of my work, this performative quality, or the moon as the moon and stars as performers, is actually something that I brought into the first strictly astrology class, intro to astrology class that I taught, is the metaphor that I used. But that is also the guiding light for this book that I'm working on. That is, or I should say, is on the verge of being released. but I do think it's worth mentioning that I don't know what how I think a lot of people are going to listen to this, or at least be driven towards listening to this, is from an astrological angle. I think that is how most people approach the lunar mansions. But to tie it to what you just brought up around the art angle, I think that even for those who are approaching the lunar mansions from a strictly astrological perspective, wherein they would do what we've been, I guess, skirting around throughout this conversation, they would do something like classic delineation, like this: the moon in this station equals this sort of thing happening, or someone with the moon natally in this station is this sort of person. Like, I guess if you're not aware of this, listening to this conversation, that is the way that it functions by and large. The magic is sort of its own thing, but really it's also an extension of that, which in that way, it's no different than most astrology. Like, the moon or a planet in this place equals this thing or this interpretation, which can be more or less poetic. But I think as you're bringing up this imagistic quality, making art from this place, even making art explicitly from the lunar stations and the way they feel, like this piece of clothing, this painting, what have you, it's performative quality. I think more than anything else that I have encountered in astrology, the lunar mansions lend themselves to that. Wherein if you are the kind of person, astrologer or otherwise, who's just doing this stuff within the paradigm of this planet in this sign equals this thing, I think the lunar mansions are the perfect way, if you want, to begin to break out of that. They are a wonderful way to start approaching systems like astrology. But I think, like I just mentioned, it could be a breakthrough even in other systems to begin to approach divination more broadly in an imagistic capacity. If you haven't been able to do that in other systems, and as you would know, Michaela, people even approach tarot not in that way. You know what I mean? It's like that can get lost. And I don't even necessarily mean reading the images on the cards as much as imagistic can also be a poetic response or a narrative response in that as well. But if you're looking through that for that breakthrough, if you're looking to move beyond being the astrologer or the diviner who's just like this planet in this thing or this placement equals this thing, then I think the lunar mansions are a great way to do that. And who knows, in undergoing that initiation, I'm going to call it, or even in going through that process, you might end up making art, like you said, on the other side of it. And in making art, you might begin doing magic. And in doing magic, you might end up making art. hence image magic. But the lunar stations are a great way of moving into that space. And I hope this conversation is testament to that. I would hope. I think we've gone in all of those directions that would lend themselves to being like, oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I have loved this conversation. It's been very inspiring. I'm immensely looking forward to reading the book. But I do always end the podcast on the same last question. So basically, this is an open mic. It's like a blank slate for you. If there's anything that you feel like we haven't touched on, anything I forgot to ask, if you want to read a poem or make some last point, you know, now is your moment.
I'm trying to get better about covering my loose ends in the midst of conversation. That has been one of my weaknesses. I will go off into these fairly niche subjects without explaining certain things that would be pretty integral for someone, even for people who are familiar with a lot of this stuff. I'm trying to get better about that and not just going off into my own musings on the thing, or just even like listening to myself talking about things. But
I totally understand.
So I do think that I have covered, I've covered a fair bit when it comes to the lunar mansions, the lunar stations, they, them, he, her, that is the moon, as well as getting to wax poetic on it as well. I want to, I would say that I'm just going to reiterate what I just said, which is that I think most of the people listening to this or who will end up listening to this are probably interested in astrology. And I feel like I haven't spoken that much about just the lunar mansions as astrology, but I'm okay with that. And I think I'm going to leave it to everything that I have said, because I did cover, you know, the lunar stations are a zodiac of sorts, 28 for the most part, similar to the solar zodiac in that way that they are signs. And as I just said, that people make their astrological interpretations based on the placement of the moon for the most part, in those signs. And, you know, I think I'm just going to leave it at that. Part of me is like, give the astrologers more, but also the other part of me is like, the astrologers have enough. Okay. They're, they are good. I hope that, I hope that this has sparked some interest in the book. That also it can be a bit of a palate wetter, and that I haven't said too much about the book because I am always interested in cultivating that air of mystery, perpetually the air of mystery. It wouldn't be the Star Night Dwell brand that is me if I didn't do that. But I have given the astrologers what I feel is a sufficient amount of information. I guess I will leave the last words to those who are interested in the imagination, those who are interested in mysticism, magic, and art, which is that I hope that they see how this relates to astrology, how it can relate to astrology, those people in the perhaps more left brain camp of things. But also how this can be its own thing and doesn't need to relate to astrology as well. I guess that is the last message that I will give to the astrologers, that the lunar stations and everything that they are, everything that we've been discussing in this conversation, is not necessary to know astrology, to study astrology, nor astrology at all being, or what we would think of as astrology, being the basis for what what I believe the lunar stations are at their roots. I think they go far above, below, beyond astrology as a system. And so I hope those who feel that pull towards the moon, the imagination, towards the stars, towards creativity around these different things, that they do not feel limited by astrology, or that they have to learn, frankly, astrology at all to be able to move into some of this, to explore some of this. And that the astrologers should know damn right, like, the lunar mansions don't need astrology to be the lunar mansions. It goes beyond the division into this 28, into the mathematical division. And the root of it truly is the relationship between various consciousnesses, various awarenesses, you know, the animals, the plants, the human beings, and all of the others, with the star beings, and with the being that is the moon, with the plurality of beings that that are the moon. And that this dialogue, which is sound, which is image, which is poetry, which is the clothing you're wearing and your environment that you're in, far before it is a codified system of astrology, that this is the root of what a lunar mansion or a lunar station is. It is not a mathematical and complex system of calculation that it is become, that it has become, though it is not in detriment. It is not detrimental to learn those things, and I am not shunning those things whatsoever, and I use them every single day of my life. But just that, if you are asking me to deliver my final message, that it is from the lunar mansions to the people through me. Me as moon, Star Night Dwell as moon, J.M. Hamadi as moon. they are like, we don't need you, astrology. You need us. And we are more like the artists and the poets of this world than we are like the astrologers. But also, we are our own thing and our own living awareness. So if you want to come talk to us, don't feel like you necessarily need to become an astrologer to do so. That's a bit of a spicy, saucy way to end it, but that feels like a really good place to leave off.
I mean, I personally love it as a person that is like not an astrologer.
Right? Like, sometimes I call myself an astrologer, sometimes I don't. I think even just in this conversation, I don't think I even introduced myself as an astrologer, so.
Artist first,
always. Absolutely, always. Yeah. Or even diviner before astrologer, I think.
Yeah. Spirit worker.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I loved this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. Again, I'm looking forward to reading the book, and I will put it to use as an artist.
Yes, yes. the moon is, we're speaking during the day, but the moon is nodding somewhere in the dark. As you say that. Who am I to speak for the moon, in all honesty? But okay, I will have that level of audacity.
I will say I heard you say that and I was like, okay, the ball's on this
I said I will not speak for God. I said
humble where it matters.
Yeah, I said I will not speak for Allah as a good Muslim, but I will have the audacity to speak and to nod at your at what you said with the moon in this instance.
I love it. Well, thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. It was a pleasure being here.